watch for launches usually on the Space X website. They always have a feed that you can watch all their live launches. Of course, it's not a NASA launch. You can't go to NASA.com and watch the launch. When it's a NASA launch, they're launching a cargo up to the space station, or they're launching a NASA satellite. Yes, then they have it on NASA TV. But otherwise, when it's a commercial launch like this one, to watch it take off and watch the booster come down and land on the ship, you usually have to go to SpaceX website, SpaceX.com. Let me drop it. The other big news is a lot of little stories during the week keep occurring. Updates on satellites that are being built, such as the Parker Solar Probe. We talked about that quite a bit last week. They talked about putting the solar panels on last week. Now there's another week has gone by. They're putting on this carbon heat shield. About 4 inches thick, and they've mounted that to the space probe, and they're getting ready for that launch, which comes in the beginning, roughly the beginning of next year. So that will be a satellite that will eventually go to the sun, about 3.7 million miles away from the sun, for about 1/8 the distance where Mercury orbits. So we'll be looking forward to seeing that thing take off. We talked about the refrigeration equipment on board to keep that thing cool when it gets near the sun. On and that, we've talked about that quite a bit. So we'll look forward to that launch. One other event that took place this week, a couple days ago, was a spacewalk on the International Space Station. Two astronauts, six astronauts on board. Two of them went out and replaced, they call it the Lee's latching end effector. It's on the end of the robotic arm, 57-foot robotic arm that they use all the time. Either carry astronauts from place to place, or they carry robots from place to place to do work, or they'll take big components, modules, living quarters. That's how they built the International Space Station, with this 7-foot robotic arm, and it's got this end effector, latching end effector, that has complex wires that twist, grab things. It'll take a whole spacecraft that's going up, for instance, SpaceX Dragon cargo vehicle, grab the whole thing and attach it or berth it to one of the other modules. And they can open the doors and go inside and unload things. So they really need this arm to be working to continue operating the space station into the future. Presently, to 2024, and my guess is they'll probably go beyond that. But they need that to have deliveries of visiting cargo vehicles to grab a hold of when they get near the space station, to grab the cargo vehicle and attach it to the ISS. You need this big robotic arm. Well, this end effector has been in use since 2001 was first sent up there, and it's starting to wear out. They've tried greasing it, get another year or two out of it. They've done that. EVAs do that work. But there's some problems. The motors have been stalling. So they have a spare, and these things are like 4,000 pounds. It's the end of the end of a crane. 4,000 pound thing has about 24 bolts to it. They spent all day out there the other day unbolting the old one, restoring that and then putting a new one on. Drop it. Turned out it was a very successful spacewalk, and they even had some time to do some get-ahead work, other work that would have to be done for the future spacewalk. They have two more spacewalks coming up next week, the week after. We go out and do some work with the end effect that they reinstalled. They have to reset a couple of other EVA activities. So, one this week, it just went by 2 days ago on the 5th. Another one next week, and another EVA following that week. So, that's pretty much it. There's other stories we can talk about, but for now I'm going to pass it over to Roy. If he has anything to add, and if not, we'll go around the loop on the net. HC2GS, welcome aboard, Roy. Over to you. This is WS1. Ready now.
Thank you, Paul. This is HC2GS, and now I actually know what it feels like to be thrown into the deep part of the pool. Iridium, you know, it originates as almost a commercial product for individuals, for satellite phones. I get the sense that they're everything but private users these days. They're commercial companies, enterprise, military, government, all that manner of things. Is that kind of correct, to your knowledge?
Yes, and they have machine-to-machine capability, you know, talk-to-talk to other computers, you know, with no voice involved whatsoever. But mainly it's used for communications. And with this new setup, these are called Iridium Next satellites. So they're much more advanced than the other ones from 20 years ago that are all are pretty much wearing out, and once they have their full 50, I think it's 66 satellites up, they should be in there. So we'll see. I'm more fascinated with the amount of time that, you know, every couple of months, it seems like 3, 4, 5 months, they're launching another 10 satellites, and they need all 66. Yeah, it's commercial users and naturally anybody else that needs it. And they're more capable of working further to the north and south poles than the older systems. So that's going to help people down in Antarctica a lot more than the older systems. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. It was fascinating technology when it was first developed, and it was, to me, rather risky when they sent up those first few satellites, and the entire commercial business model seemed to explode on itself. So it's nice that they were able to recoup their losses somehow and extend the technology into something even more powerful than they once thought of. So it's nice to hear a success story with technology instead of it just kind of burning out someplace.
Yeah, I remember reading about this UFO probably in the early 1990s when they were getting ready to launch the early version of the Iridium. It sounded like this was going to be great. They had 77 satellites ready to go. And they started launching them. And they picked the number 77. They needed, there was like 7 in 10 different orbits, different inclinations. So 7 in each group. And now, for some reason, they've gone down to 6. So, I think originally they planned on 77. They called it iridium, because iridium had 77 electrons surrounding the atom. But they took that number, and then they come back on a number. It might have gone back to 66 back then. I don't remember, but nevertheless, they got up there. They were working okay, but as time went on, they, like you said, they were having some kind of financial problem. And then as years went on, I guess maybe somebody else invested into it, or maybe they sold out. I don't know. Next thing you know, they came up with iridium next. Let me drop it. And they plan on launching all of them from SpaceX Falcon 9. There was a couple of them. We're going to be, last year, we're going to be launched by Russia. And now that has been canceled. They had a contract with them because of all the problems with the Ukraine, and this and that. The Ukraine built some of their rockets. And the Thor rocket was going to launch a couple of these new Iridium satellites. But that was canceled, but now the contract is 100% with SpaceX. But now there's more room on the satellite, so they're going to add a couple of other completely different satellites called Grace. Two Grace satellites, which have nothing to do with communication. They're scientific satellites that are going to study gravity. Going around now. Polar orbits following one another. Study gravitation fields. So, that's pretty much it. I don't know if anybody else has any questions dealing with this topic or anything to do with the space program. Let me turn over to the group. This is WS2N. His name here is Paul.
Hey, sure, Jay.
Two questions.
Okay, I heard Eric first. So we'll go to you after that. K2J. Go ahead.
Yeah, Paul, I wonder if you remember when Iridium was created. It was done by Motorola. When Motorola was still a big company before it got broken up into little bits and sold off. And while that was happening, that's when they ran into a lot of finance.
Yeah, I didn't remember what company was behind it, but yeah, okay. And somehow they got more money, or you know, some kind of business deal went through, and it turned out that it worked out for the better. Now this is all for voice and phone, and they're eventually going to have not these people, but something called Net One. That one is developing some 900 different satellites, all going to these crazy orbits, similar to this type of orbit, and that's going to be for computer communication. Their idea is to link the world, like a billion people or so that do not get the internet, cannot get the internet. Or you might be, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Montana somewhere, and you don't have a cable going to your house. You'll be able to point your antenna to the sky and have a great real-time communication. You won't have that delay going up to a satellite. So you have that one eventually developing a system like that. SpaceX has plans of doing the same thing, like 1,400 satellites. So there's going to be so many satellites up in the air in the future. It's going to be hard to follow all these launches that are coming up. There was another station that checked it, that made a comment along with Eric. Let me pause and see if I can pick that station up. Was there another station that had a question or comment to the
Good question.
Okay, it sounds like HC2LR. Is that UK? If it is, it's popping in and out a little bit.
Yes, it's me, HC2LR. I'm going to... Yes. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, I heard that sentence, and then right at the end, it sounds like it's almost like you're unkeyed very quickly. But try and make a transmission and see how it goes.
Okay, I would love if you would explain how the Iridium satellites communicate with each other. I heard you say something about Iridium satellites using Iridium communication, is that right?
No, they just use your standard RF system. The Iridium name comes from the amount of satellites they originally planned on setting up. I believe it was 77, so on a periodic table, if you look up Iridium, they have like 77 electrons going around it. So that's where they got the name. But, they communicate with each other, just like all the other satellites using RF, probably, 2.4 gig or something. I don't even know the frequencies that they use. What a surprise if Eric knows, so he's up on that. Back to you, Jay.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to hear about that. I had no idea. I don't know anything about Iridium satellites almost, so I wanted to just learn more. But Eric, if you know, I would love to hear anything you have to say about the communication between Iridium satellites.
It's been a long time since I've looked at that. Years ago, we used it when it was available to us. I believe that somewhere 1600 megahertz range is a form of spectrum. But don't quote me on it. I mean, when I get back to where I'm going, I can look it up and keep it in the back of my mind.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask my second question, which is really like a physics question more than a space question?
You have it, Jay. Go right ahead.
Okay, so I was working with a fourth grade class, and I was telling them how the Earth rotates at 1,000 miles per hour at the equator. And one of the children asked, why don't we feel it? And I said, the same way that a fly can fly around in the cabin of a car when the car is going, the things around you are moving at the same speed, you don't notice it. So another kid asked, if the car stops short, everybody feels it and you will get thrown forward. If the Earth stops, would we feel it? And I know this is more of a dick question because it's kind of speculation whether gravity would hold us in place or what would happen. But I told them I'd try to find out and get back to them next week. Does anyone have any answer to that? This is AT2LR.
AT2GN, fourth grade, is getting smarter and smarter as time moves on. Yeah, that would be an extinction event, I would think. If the Earth suddenly stopped, we'd all stop moving. That would be like a 1,000-mile-an-hour crash. So, yeah, at the equator, we're going at 1,000, but you can go up to the North Pole or the South Pole and stand there. And as far as that east-west direction goes, you're not going anywhere. And then you can go at 145 degrees north or 45 degrees south. Going about 500 miles an hour, the speed changes, and the reason you don't feel it is because you're standing going on the equator. All that air, everything's moving with you. So it's not like you're going into a 1,000-mile-an-hour wind. But when it comes to the wind, you have the Coriolis effect when we drop it. You know, you see these big hurricanes. You see the way they're turning. And let's say that they develop, you know, maybe 10 degrees off the north of the equator. And as they're coming out, you can see the wind. The winds near the equator are going faster than the wind north of the equator. So if the center of the hurricane is the 20 degrees north or to the south, the actual spin of the earth and the wind is actually going to push the winds in the fully direction. Therefore, the winds going north are going to be relatively going in relation to that, actually going backwards. So it's a low pressure center right in the middle. So the winds have to go somewhere. So the winds are being pushed out near the water, going out one direction. North, east, south, and west. Basically, that's why you have the turning cyclone.
Come in.
Okay, I was going to say it's the opposite, south of the equator. Yeah, go ahead, comment.
Hi, George, KD2FIU. I can't help but think of it just as an input, a thought here. The earth stopped spinning. I think the sun would suck it right in.
Yes. Well, I don't know. We could stop spinning and we'll still go around the sun, I think, George. If we stop going around the sun, that's another thing. We're going around the sun at 66,000 miles per hour. So forget about the 1,000 miles an hour on the equator. I mean, relative to the sun itself, we're moving 66,000 miles per hour around that sun. So if that motion stops, if all of a sudden we decide to stop, wouldn't be, you'd lose your centrifugal forward motion. And yes, George, you're right. And then at that point, you'll start heading into the sun. There was another station. Go ahead.
Yeah, KC2GS.
GS, yes. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, well, there's types of momentum. There's linear momentum, there's angular momentum. The angular momentum of the Earth rotating, if it stopped, everything would continue on because of angular momentum, and buildings would collapse. You'd fly off the planet, possibly skipped by gravity 100 miles or so. It would be a bloody mess. If you were in the north or the south pole, it would be less of a bloody mess initially, but soon after, all the trouble that was caused in the equator and all over the place would reach you. So it would be a catastrophe that no life would persist. And Paul's quite right. It's the orbital momentum that keeps us away from the sun. We could spin or not spin on our axis, and the sun really doesn't give a damn. But if we stop rotating around the sun, then there'll be no opposing force for gravity, and we'll spiral into the sun.
Yeah, right. I think, like the moon. The moon is actually rotating only once a month, right? So it's facing us. So it's not the spin of the moon. That's not really spinning much. The moon doesn't come barreling in at the Earth. I think the moon is going 6,000 miles per hour around the Earth, I recall. So very good. So I hope this doesn't keep the fourth graders up at night, okay? So back over to you, AC2LR of radio, WS1.
Hey, Paul, if the Earth stopped rotating, it would stop generating gravity, and I think you'd have some atmosphere, yeah?
I disagree with that. Gravity is mass-related, not purely centrifugal.
And I give you a tick there. I know if the Earth stops moving, let's see, that would be 1,000-mile-an-hour wind, a sudden wind at the equator. So that would be life-changing. That would be an event that most humans, I don't think, would live through, unless you were on the space station. You know, you'd still be flying around the Earth. The Earth could be standing still, doesn't matter. And the ISS would still be going around and around. So would all your satellites. So they would all be operating. I don't think the atmosphere would leave the Earth. Maybe, you're going to have things crash into each other 1,000 miles an hour, but that wouldn't be fast enough to push the Earth or the atmosphere off away from the Earth. That's the way it goes. Let's see if anybody else has any comments on this topic or any other questions. This is WS2N.
AC2GS again.
You have it, Roy.
I think that the problem is conceiving of gravity being affected by the rotation. Rotation will give you inertia, will give you forces, and gravity gives you forces, but they're not the same forces. And depending upon how much momentum is going into the air and everything around the air when the Earth stops rotating, if it's stronger than the force of gravity from the mass of the planet, then we all fly off the surface of the Earth. If not, we just skid around it somewhat.
Go ahead, Kay.
Hey, come on, Buck. I have two thoughts on this. Come on, Buck. One is the velocity from Earth is 25,000 miles per hour, right? So, I remember a physics equation from when I was in college. How fast someone will fly off a merry-go-round if the merry-go-round stops short. You apply the F equals F. You have to have the how heavy and see if you get mass. That's the other thing I was going to conversation. Back to you, Paul. AC2LR.
Okay, and popping in and out a little bit. Yeah, it sounds like you're making the analogy that you're on a merry-go-round, it's going fast enough, wind up letting go, you're going to go out on a tangent, and that thing could be whatever it was. Yeah, the satellites are, satellites that are near LEOs, they call low Earth orbit satellites, such as the International Space Station, flying at 250 miles above the Earth, that's going at 17,500 miles an hour, so every 90 minutes it goes around the Earth. So again, if the Earth stops, the space station won't care if the Earth is spinning or not, or speed it up. So that would keep going. The only thing that would change is if the atmosphere changed a little bit. You're going to have more of a resistance going into the atmosphere. Actually, that does happen. When the sun has coronal mass ejection, it tends to heat up the atmosphere. The atmosphere starts to expand, and there are molecules up near the space station, and there will be more molecules. The atmosphere expands below it, and it tends to slow the space station down a little bit. They have to compensate for that every now and then. But stopping the Earth is going to be one of the problems. Any other comments?
QLR.
What happened with the magnetic field?
Yeah, that would be a problem. I think you would lose that. Okay.
Just thinking. Feel. Everything on the surface anyway.
That transmission broke up too much, Kay. We missed that. You have a different, slightly different location.
So I'll just listen.
Okay, you said yeah. Okay, you're just gonna listen now. Yeah. Probably battery problem. And thank the fourth grader for that question. Tell him it was a good question. Let's see, somebody else just said something besides Kay. Who was that? Okay, nothing heard. Let's see if anybody has a question dealing with the space program or anything else. We'll be listening. This is WS2N. Anybody?
Someone brought up a good point about if you stop the Earth rotating, you stop that molten core of iron, you stop the magnetic field, then you destroy the ozone layer and all manner of wonderful things. So by then we've all been flung across this world and all civilization and most life is gone anyway. But in addition, you'd be stuck with a planet that didn't have a protective magnetic field surrounding it.
Yes, essentially we would become Mars. You know, that's what happened. That's the theory behind Mars. It was a smaller planet than us, so it didn't have as much of a molten interior. It still spins roughly the same amount of time that we do. But because it was smaller, it solidified quicker and lost its magnetic field. And now you lose your magnetic field, you lose your protection from the wind, the solar wind that's coming in. You have this magnetic field where everything starts going to either the South Pole or North Pole, and that's directly blasted into the Earth with this ultraviolet radiation killing everything in sight. And then after that, you'll have possibly a situation like Venus, though. I don't know if you would wind up with losing the atmosphere like Mars. Let me drop it. Because even though the Earth wouldn't be spinning, you still have that gravitational effect, and the atmosphere would be still stuck to Earth. But Mars has a weaker gravitational field. It's believed that the solar wind not only didn't go to the poles, but hit the atmosphere and stripped away a lot of the hydrogen and whatever atmosphere Mars had at that time. I don't think that would happen to us, but we could wind up maybe more like Venus. As the clouds build up, you could have a greenhouse effect. Next thing you know, you have higher temperatures. I think it's like 900 degrees Fahrenheit on Venus. It might go that way, but I don't know. Let's hope that don't happen. Let me drop it. One other topic I just wanted to bring up in the space category is there's an inflatable structure that was put on the International Space Station about a year ago, and it's called the Beam. It's built by Bigelow Aerospace, and Beam is an acronym for Bigelow Expandable Activity Module. And this thing is basically almost like a sphere. It's about 13 feet by 10 feet, and it's attached to the one of the nodes or modules of the International Space Station. In particular, it's attached to Tranquility. There's three nodes. There's Unity, and then there's Harmony, and then there's Tranquility. Tranquility was the last node that was attached. A node is a module, and they have all these different six possible openings that can be opened, and you can attach a different parts of the module. You just have the space station, you can attach different things, space station to dock with you, that type of thing. Well, the Dragon spacecraft had brought the beam up a year and a half ago. And this Canadian robot arm that I was talking about earlier, with this latching hand effect attached to the beam module, the beam was collapsed and located inside the Dragon spacecraft. It's called the trunk of the spacecraft. Dragon has a pressurized area where they open it up the inside and take out thousands of pounds of stuff that sends up to the astronauts. But in the back, it's an open area to a vacuum, and that's where some of the big pieces nowadays are brought up. The beam was brought out by the robotic arm and attached to the tranquility nose. And then there it sat for quite a while, a week or two. Until eventually Jeff Williams, one of the American astronauts, his job was to increase the pressure inside the beam, and it did. It increased, it got bigger and bigger, and it tripled its size. And it became a volume of 500 cubic feet, where you could go inside and float around. And all inflated, and it's got a very thick wall. And the idea was to be able to bring up something lightweight, compact, and have it expand. Bigelow has plans of making even bigger units, 10 times the size, in the not-too-distant future. He successfully launched two smaller versions of this, called Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, back in 2007, I believe it was. And they're still floating around in space in orbit as a proof-of-concept type of spacecraft. So that works, it's still working. They never deflated. They never got any holes from meteorites. And now this thing is attached to the space station. Every couple of months or so, they open a door, and the astronauts go inside, and they have equipment inside to test and make sure there's no radiation getting through or anything like this. The original plan for beam was the attachment to solid units. And then they were going to disconnect beam and let it burn up over the Pacific Ocean. The test was going to be over. But it's working so good that NASA decides, let's keep it attached, and we'll use it as a storage room. And now they're eventually going to start bringing in, they got hundreds of these bags of things that are all within the space station, always clogging things up. Now they're going to have a whole room to store more stuff. Not that they don't have another room. They do have one other room that's even larger than me, but that's one of the solid metal modules that are up there, and that's called the Leonardo module. Leonardo was, 25 foot, 30 foot long module, 14 feet diameter, that the shuttle used to bring up on a regular basis. And the shuttle used to attach it to these space stations. They used to disconnect it at the end of the shuttle flight, put all kinds of equipment inside, and it would fly it home. And it did this maybe, 8 or 9 different times over the years with these modules. So the last flight, they decided, well, let's refabricate this thing and make it for, permanent use. And they did. They took Leonardo and on Earth, and they poured some money into it, and they made it where they could make it a permanent module. And it's attached to the space station. In fact, originally it was attached to a different port, but now it's they moved that to a different location. But they use it kind of like a basement. They store tons and tons of stuff. You know, everything from bags of water to food to clothes. Drop it. Everything has pretty much an RFID tag on it. We figure out where everything is. It's all categorized and analyzed. Now they're going to have basically two rooms like that. They're going to use the beam. So that's pretty big news for the Bigelow Corporation, because now they've seen that the confidence in his creation is not only being accepted, but they're going to just leave it attached to the space station probably for at least a couple more years, maybe beyond that. So I bring that up. We covered beam a lot extensively when it did go up a year and a half or so ago. This WS2N prototype meant space portion part of the net. Anybody have any questions, comments, technical or otherwise?
So Paul, it's like a space-based bounce castle, eh?
It's like a space-based, I missed the last word. Go ahead, Roy.
A bounce castle, you know, that kids' attraction where they inflate things and the kids go into the castle and bounce on it?
Bounce castle, yes, yes. It's probably about that big, too. It's got these four telescopic rods that are on the inside, and they push the whole thing out, and plus the air was going into it at the same time. And it took them a long time to inflate this thing. But you're not going to bounce around inside. They say when you feel the walls on the inside, it's like concrete. I mean, it's just a very solid structure. And we tried to find out exactly how thick the walls were. And that was a big topic on the net. And I'm thinking it's like 8 inches. But they wouldn't release that information. They said that was proprietary information from Bigelow. We can't tell you. But it's a series of layers of Kevlar and Zultron, and something called Zultron, and all these different layers of things. And when it's inflated, they say it's like concrete, and yet if you get hit with a micrometeorite, they say you have more of a chance of a little meteorite going through a metal can, like the rest of the space station, than this thing. It's kind of like absorbable, you know, like hitting a tire almost of a car. It would bounce right, kind of bounce off. And they say there's no marks or anything over a year in space. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, so it's more of a bulletproof bounce castle. By the way, K1MJM checked into Echo Link and wanted to tell everyone that, hello, he's apparently in Puerto Rico and their internet is kind of flaky. So he just wanted me to pass on that message to everyone.
Really? He must be down as one of the volunteers that went down there?
That would be my surmise. He really didn't give me too many details. He just said that he's in Puerto Rico right now, and the internet is spotty. But I would assume he wouldn't be as unlucky to book a vacation there right before the hurricane. So he's probably one of those guys helping out.
Wow, that's terrific. Mike, very active. I think there was 50 people that went down there. Just read a report. I don't know if it was an email from the ARRL and talked about the volunteers, but it was sent to a lot of different hospitals. They're setting up repeaters. One guy was having trouble. He was, I think 75 miles away or so, wherever he wanted to talk to. So this ham put together, well, that's what I think you were talking about, Roy, the tape measure type of antenna, like made a Yagi out of it, constructed something like that. And I think it was the ARRL news newsletter that comes out every week. I remember reading what's going on. Two of the hands were sent to an island that nobody's even been to yet. One of the islands off of the coast of Puerto Rico, part of Puerto Rico. I'd like to have that job. You don't even know what you're walking into. So, they must be doing some great job down there. Back to you, Royce, any comment? AC2GSWS, you might be.
AC2GS. Yeah, the Red Cross, I think, is coordinating it all and asked for some help from the ARRL. It's a three-week tour, 50 amateurs, and when they're done with their 3 weeks, chances are there's going to be at least one more ship. There'll probably be two or three other ships because things are unfortunately very bad down there. Cell towers are non-functional. Power is out to the majority of people. Even potable water is a very big problem there still. The entire infrastructure was kind of half-shot by the economic situation that they had before the hurricane, and the hurricane just finished it off.
Yeah, and it's going to take some time before they get any kind of reliable communication up. They have 9%, I think the article said 9% of electricity going. Most of that is in San Juan. But, you know, you take a mile, it's like Long Island, about 120 miles long by 17 wide. This is 100 miles by, I think they say 35 miles. But with more people on that island than, you know, Nassau County and Suffolk County combined, so it's going to be quite a long time before they can get that place back into shape. And I think it was Newsday. Talked about another little island that just has monkeys on it. They call it Monkey Island when they drop it. And that's the first part because it was on the east part of the part of Puerto Rico. That's the first island that got hit with this Hurricane Maria. And they said nothing was left on this island. It's like an island where all the scientists go to do experiments with DNA and been tracking these things like forever. Every monkey that's born, they tag and keep track of and some kind of not much about biology, but some of the doctors that are researching these things, they consider it very important, and they don't want to lose this one island. And meanwhile, you got, you know, millions of people that are in bad shape, so they're finding it hard to finally get food or whatever it is to save these animals. And how they ever survive on this island, they say they don't know, you know. But animals are pretty good at it. I mean, there's a lot of them that can kill, but they always manage to survive. Any other comments?
N2H3R with a question.
N2BHR, I think it is. Yeah, go ahead and name your Paul. What's the name?
Yeah, the call is November 2, Hotel Victor Radio. The name is Nick. Hi, Paul. I just want to switch gears and just briefly mention the James Webb Telescope. My question is this. I was reading somewhere, and I actually attended a lecture Friday at the Kaufman Theater in the Museum of Natural History. And what I wanted to know is this satellite, when it goes up, it will be able to detect extraterrestrial planets directly. In other words, we'll be able to see planets themselves without the Doppler shift. We'll actually be to see extraterrestrial planets directly. Is that true? Back to you, Paul.
I know they're going to be able to analyze the atmosphere believe they, of a lot of these planets, as the planet goes in front of their sun, what we consider their star, the light going through, when it goes through their atmosphere, we'll be able to detect what that's made of, oxygen, methane. That'll come back on the spectroscope on board the Infrared Space Telescope. That I've heard. Whether it will be able to see it directly, I haven't heard. I would imagine it's going to be a pinpoint of, maybe a pixel. I don't think so. The light of the sun is going to be still overwhelming. But they are going to be able to, because they know it now, the mass, and they know the, they'll be able to combine that existing information with now the chemicals that are coming out in the atmosphere. They might be able to deduce what the planet looks like. But seeing it directly, I'm not really sure. Has anybody heard that?
AC2GS, I haven't heard that either, and it's probably not a good term, extraterrestrial planet, because every planet other than Earth is an extraterrestrial planet. I think you meant extrasolar planets, planets outside of the solar system.
Yeah, is that right, Nick? Back to you.
And it's outside our solar, planets around other stars, correct? Yeah, thank you, correct.
Yeah, I think it might be able to see, some planet, that's maybe a distance from the star. I think it might have a chance of finding something like that. Even now, the Hubble, they see accretion disks around would-be planets that are going around stars. I've seen pictures of that. You can see that with Hubble. I mean, you're only a step away from actually being a pinpoint of something that's called a planet. They have a future telescope and beyond James Webb. I guess they're going to call it for now the Next Generation Telescope. That's what they used to call James Webb before they gave it a name, the Next Generation Telescope. And they have a plan on sending this thing out. It's going to have a coronagraph in front of it, way in front of it, like miles in front of the spacecraft itself. And that's going to black out the light of the star. And then there's, actual telescope will be able to, so it'll send it up to two parts, the launch will probably be with our space launch system that we're building. The heaviest rocket ever to be produced, like 10 million pounds of thrust. They'll probably put two of these things up. Coronagraph, which will open up like an origami setup, maybe the size of a football field out in front of you. And then the spacecraft will be sitting behind it. They said if they ever develop that, then they would be able to actually visually see a planet. Be able to knock out that light of the star. James Webb will undoubtedly change everything. This is going to be much more effective than Hubble. Watching these documentaries, I think Hubble goes back to 100, I think a billion years or something after the Big Bang, and this thing's going to go back, maybe down to 100 million years or something after the Big Bang. So that'll be interesting. But first, they got to get it off the ground. It's going to be launched on an Ariane 5 rocket from South America, from French Guiana, Kourou launch facility. We have a deal with the European Space Agency to launch it, and it was supposed to go off at the end of 2018, the end of next year, like September or October. But now it's been confirmed that about a couple of weeks ago that it will not be launching until the spring of 2019, so we got some time to go. We're going to go all the way through next year. scheduled time, but now it's been delayed. They're having some problems with some of the instrumentation, not having that be put together in time. That was a combination of, there's another spacecraft called Columbo Pepe spacecraft that's supposed to be launched by the European Space Agency. European Space Agency also from French Guiana on an Ariane 5 rocket right around the same time, and that's going to go into orbit around Mercury. So that has a certain window. It has to go off at a certain time. And I believe it was conflicting with the James Webb Space Telescope. James Webb Space Telescope doesn't have to go off at a certain time. They're going to be putting it 1 million miles away from the Earth at the Lagrange Point 2, L2. It'll be sitting there with a sunshade in front of it, keeping it protected. That sunshade is going to be opened up as big as a tennis court. It's got five different layers of mylar to heat away from the telescope itself. And the detectors, plus it has a refrigeration system on board to even bring the temperatures to a lower cryogenic temperature than what can be done just with sunshade. So it's interesting, 100 different pieces have to operate to open up the sunshade, and then a couple of dozen more for the telescope itself. It's got a one bulb, and hopefully this thing is going to work. And now I just read not too long ago about $10 billion project. It used to be $8 billion, say $8 billion. Now I heard it's $10 billion. So I have to confirm that. I only saw that in one location. Actually, it was a magazine. We'll have to see if that's still true. If the price went up another $2 billion in the last couple of years. Any other comments on that? This is WS2M.
AC2GS. Well, one of the things also you got to keep in mind with these wonderful devices that are counting the number of galaxies in the universe is that there's some limitations. There's technical limitations as far as resolution and intensities that we can pick up. And there's something called the light cone. There are some parts of the universe that are so far away that the light from their stars hasn't even reached us yet. So it's, you know, no way of knowing what those are. You know, we just kind of picked up the fact that instead of 200 billion galaxies in our known universe, there's now 2 trillion. So who knows what the next satellite study will show.
That's a big number. It doesn't pay to memorize anything anymore. I remember memorizing the 9 planets and how many moons were around each planet. You know, I know how many moons were around Saturn when I was younger. But now it's like 64 moons just around Saturn. And now you're jumping to 2 million galaxies. I wonder if James Webb at one point, I wonder if they'll try a deep field experiment like Hubble has done actually a couple of times. That would be interesting. See what they come up with. Hubble is hopefully going to keep operating. That's the other thing. If I wanted Hubble and James Webb to be up there at the same time, and as time goes by, you know, Hubble has not been serviced now since 2009. I remember in 2009 they said they'd be happy if this thing, if they can get another 7 years out of it. Well, you know, that time has ticked by, and now they're looking for at least another 2 years or so to be operating at the same time as James Webb Space Telescope. You know, you have the two things look at the same picture at the same time. They'll be able to coordinate, maybe even calibrate James Webb to a certain degree better than without Hubble. But you never know. Maybe one day we'll have